Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Michael Hansen. Dr. Michael Hansen is a senior staff scientist with Consumers Union, which is the publisher of Consumer Reports. Dr. Hansen is one of the world's leading scientific experts on food and agricultural policy and on how they impact public health. He served on the USDA Advisory Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology and on the California Department of Food and Agriculture Food Biotechnology Advisory Committee. Dr. Hansen represents Consumers International, which is a federation of more than 250 organizations in 110 countries at Codex Alimentarius and other international forums, and he's testified in dozens of hearings. So now, Dr. Hansen, my dad and I are so grateful to have the benefit of your seasoned insights today. And now, for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and welcome, Dr. Hansen.
Nice
I
to
want
be
to
here.
Start with antibiotics in the food supply and in meat production. We know that more than 80% of all the antibiotics sold in the country today are not given to people who are ill. They are used on animals, most of whom aren't even sick. Healthy cows and pigs and chickens are routinely fed antibiotics to enable them to cope with the filthy and intensely crowded conditions in industrial feedlots and factory farms. Consumers Union, the policy arm of Consumer Reports, is asking grocery stores to take a stand for public health and to say no to meat from animals raised this way, and in particular is now targeting Trader Joe's, since the chain continues to sell meat raised on antibiotics. As Consumers Union's senior scientist, I want to ask you, how important is this issue to you, and what do people need to know about the issue of antibiotics in their food?
Well, this is actually a very important issue because resistance to antibiotics is considered a global health concern, and it's due to both overuse in human medicine, but also this overuse and misuse in animal medicine because, as you have properly pointed out, that's where the bulk of antibiotics are being used. Now, the FDA has said that they're taking action because they're finalizing this proposal that they're going to stop the use of these low levels of antibiotics for growth promotion purposes, just to make the animals grow more quickly. And while that's a good step forward, it still leaves open a large loophole, and that's the area of disease prevention, right? So that if there might be a problem with some of your animals getting sick, well, you dose all of them. And so it's just another way of, you can either call it growth promotion or disease prevention. These large amounts of antibiotics will still probably continue to be used, and they do need to be drastically reduced because this is a serious public health concern. Antibiotic resistance is considered one of the most important public health concerns globally.
At least 2 million Americans fall sick every year, and another 23,000 die from antibiotic-resistant infections. These numbers come from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The drug industry, and particularly the companies that manufacture the antibiotics that are used in factory farms today, are saying that they don't expect this new action on the part of the FDA to cut into their business at all. What's your view?
Well, I'm glad they're saying that because the FDA has been saying, look, we're taking these action. We're stopping all growth promotion uses. And the companies have now all agreed that they'll only use antibiotics judiciously. And we've come back and said, yes, that's good, but there's still these loopholes. And the industry now is confirming that. They're functionally saying this is not going to reduce the amount of antibiotics that we're selling. And ultimately, those levels are going to have to be drastically decreased because the greater the use of antibiotics, the more you're selecting for resistance. And these resistance traits, they're not, even though they might be selected in one bacteria, they can be passed back and forth to bacteria that don't even normally mate with each other. You can pass antibiotic resistance from a Campylobacter to an E. coli to a Salmonella to almost any other bacteria. So we have to reduce the total amount of antibiotics that are being used. So it's good that the companies are saying that, well, it's bad in a way, but it's good the companies are being honest in saying that this voluntary approach isn't going to work in terms of reducing the amount of antibiotics that are being used, and that's why we need actions to be taken. Either this new PAMTA law should be passed, and we think there should be a lot of data taken on exactly how much antibiotics are used for what purposes, so that we can monitor to see whether there is a decreasing problem.
When the drug companies talk to the press about the FDA's mandates and recommendations, they don't say that it won't have any effect on their sales. They say that, though, when they're talking to their shareholders.
Right, and that's why it's important to know that distinction, because when they're talking to their shareholders, they're obviously being more honest, and this just reinforces our view that these voluntary measures by the FDA are not enough. More action does need to be taken, and again, I would point out that the CDC has even pointed out how problematic antibiotic resistant is, how this is such a high-level priority, and how we have to take action, not just in human medicine, but they say the total amount of antibiotics used in agriculture are important as well, and that needs to be reduced. So that's very clear that we're not going to see any advancements until there are laws that actually will lead to the reduction in the amount of antibiotics that are used in animal agriculture, particularly for disease prevention and disease control, because those are big loopholes that functionally allow these industrial facilities to continue to operate.
I'm remembering a seminal study back in the 1970s, the microbiologist Stuart Levy conducted it, and he, of course, is a major player today in this topic. In that study, he administered small amounts of the antibiotic tetracycline to a flock of chickens, and very soon the chickens were carrying E. coli bacteria that were resistant, and resistant not only to tetracycline but to other antibiotics as well. And then within weeks, the farmers who tended those birds also carried resistant bacteria.
Right. Yeah, and we actually know a lot more. That was done decades ago. And since that work, we now know part of how these mechanisms are working. When low levels of antibiotics are being given to animals, the way the bacteria responds is these resistance factors, they start shedding them into the environment sometimes at 1,000 times the rate. And then these resistance factors, they can just all start combining with each other. So on one, what's called circular plasmid, on one piece of DNA, you can have now resistance, not just to one, but to two or three or four or five or six, these multiply resistant plasmids. They're just all sort of in this stew combining together. And it's ironic, but back in 1977, even the FDA realized that this low levels of tetracycline and penicillin are a problem, and they actually proposed banning them. They told the companies, you have the choice to come forward to present information as to why we shouldn't ban them. And what happened is rather than the companies coming forward, they went to Congress, and Congress put pressure on the FDA not to act. And then at the end of 2012, the FDA formally withdrew that proposal that they had made in 1977. In the meantime, there had been a lawsuit by NRDC brought against the FDA for saying that these things should be pulled off the market because they aren't safe. And the court has ruled against FDA to take this action against penicillin and tetracycline used at low levels. And so they did try to take action over 35 years ago, almost 38 years ago now, and still nothing has happened on those two drugs, and things have gone on, and we now know that all these other low-level antibiotics that are being given to animals, those are all problematic as well, and action needs to be taken against all of them.
Well, thank you for your wisdom on that topic. I want to shift us over now to another area. We frequently hear that there is a scientific consensus on the safety of genetically engineered crops. This is an assertion that there is such a consensus that has been the foundation of Monsanto's ad campaigns, and it's one that the biotech and junk food industries use in their efforts to defeat ballot initiatives that would mandate labeling.
Mm-hmm.
The message is that the scientific community is united behind GMOs, and to question them is anti-science. How do you feel about that?
Well, this notion that there's a consensus on GMO safety is just not true. I can point out that there was this controversial feeding study by Dr. Cirillini, this rat feeding study that was published in 2012 and was withdrawn in November of 2013. And yet, in spite of that, not only has that retraction of that study been condemned, but the European Union announced last July that they will now be spending 3 million euros, which is about $4 million U.S., on a two-year cancer feeding study of this Roundup Ready corn, this NK603, which Cirillini had looked at. Recently, at the end of October, there was a global document called There's No Scientific Consensus on GMO Safety, and that was signed by scientists, physicians, academics, and experts from disciplines relevant to the scientific, legal, social, and safety assessment aspects of GMOs. And there's now over 300 scientists who've signed that. That statement says they strongly reject claims by the GMC developers and scientists and journalists and others that there's a, quote, scientific consensus on GMO safety.
You mentioned the Cirillini study, and this was a study that the French scientist Cirillini published a couple years ago in the journal Food and Chemical Toxicology. He found that rats fed a steady diet of Monsanto's Roundup Ready corn developed more tumors and died sooner than rats in a control group.
Yes.
There was a tremendous amount of pressure put on the journal, and it ended up, as you mentioned, retracting the study. What were the criticisms of the study, and are those criticisms valid, and what do you think actually is the real reason they retracted the article?
Well, there's three things here. First, there were two main criticisms of that Cirillini study. One, that there were too few rats used per group, that they only tested 10 rats, and that's not enough to demonstrate health problems or to demonstrate cancer. And then the second problem was they said that the strain of rat they used, the Sprague Dowley rats, they're prone to mammary tumors as they age. So the fact that older animals get all these tumors, well, that's to be expected because of the type of rat. There's problems with each of those criticisms. First, with the sample size being too small, well, that was the exact same sample size that Monsanto used when they did their 90-day feeding study that was published in the same journal, Food Chemical Toxicology, back in 2004, and that they concluded that this shows that there's no safety questions. So if 10 rats is too small a number to demonstrate a problem, how can you then say using 10 rats is perfectly okay to show that there's no problem? That's inconsistent, because what Cirillini did is basically did the Monsanto study over and ran it for 2 years rather than 90 days. So he used the same number of rats that Monsanto did. As for the strain of rat, well, he used the same strain that Monsanto had used in the 90-day feeding study, because if you then ran that for 2 years, if you used a different strain of rat, if you would have gotten an adverse effect, you wouldn't know if it was due to the corn or due to the strain of rat used. And I should point out that for that strain of rat, that's the one that actually is now being used by our National Institutes of Health to do, guess what, long-term cancer studies. So these rats are the ones that are used to do these two-year studies. So I think that gets rid of both of those concerns. But even more importantly, when they retracted this paper, the editor-in-chief of Food Chemical Toxicology, when he said it was retracted, he said that they, quote, found no evidence of fraud or international misrepresentation of the data. They said the reason they were withdrawing it was because the results were inconclusive because of small sample size and the strain of a rat used. If you look, the publisher of Food Chemical Toxicology, Elsevier, is a member of what's called COPE, the Committee on Publication Ethics. The Committee on Publication Ethics have said that there's only four reasons for retracting a scientific article. And those are, one, scientific misconduct or honest error, two, prior publication that it was published elsewhere, three, plagiarism taken from someone else, or four, unethical research. None of those reasons apply for the Seralini study, and the editor explicitly said that. So it should be pointed out they didn't even follow their own guidelines because they're a member of this Committee on Publication Ethics. Should be pointed out that more than 150 scientists have signed a statement condemning the retraction of that article as an attack on scientific integrity, and they demand that Food Chemical Toxicology reinstate the study. Even more importantly, at the end of February of this year, an NIH-associated publication, Environmental Health Perspectives, published an editorial that was signed by Lynn Goldman, who's now at Johns Hopkins but was an assistant administrator at EPA. And here's what they had to say. Again, Environmental Health Perspectives is an NIH-published journal. Their editorial concluded, quote, "Efforts to suppress scientific findings or the appearance of such erode the scientific integrity upon which the public trust relies. We feel the decision to retract a published scientific work by an editor against the desires of the authors because it is, quote, inconclusive based on a post hoc analysis represents a dangerous erosion of the underpinnings of the peer review process, and Elsevier should carefully reconsider this decision," end quote. That's a very powerful statement. And again, it is coming from someone signed on to by someone who is an assistant administrator at EPA. So there have been many people that have condemned that retraction and have pointed out it doesn't meet any of the internationally accepted guidelines for why to retract a paper. So that suggests that perhaps the reason it was retracted was because the editor-in-chief brought in a new editor to deal with issues like biotechnology, and that new editor is someone who used to work for and who has gotten a fair amount of money from Monsanto and the other biotech seed companies.
I'm reminded of a statement that you made that I have always found provocative. You said that any study you want to do with these engineered crops, you need to get the company's permission. You asked, could you imagine if tobacco research was only done when the tobacco companies had the final say? It seems like in this case, Seralini was doing a study, and the biotech companies, maybe through Mr. Goodman, want the final say on this. What does this imply to the whole development of GMOs in our food supply?
Well, it doesn't suggest anything good, but it's not surprising. Because I should also point out there was a very important study done in 2011 published in Food Policy by Diels et al. And these are scientists who normally have looked at issues of the, you know, impact of tobacco companies on research on tobacco or the food companies on research on foods. And so they did a very carefully designed study where three independent scientists, one scoured a database, PubMed and Scopus, looking for feeding studies on the safety assessment of engineered foods or their nutritional quality. So one scientist pulls all these papers they can find on that. There were 97 of them. A second scientist, independent from the first, that second scientist's job is to read all those papers and characterize them as positive, negative, or neutral on GMOs. Do they cause a problem, not? Or was there a neutral finding? The third scientist then looks at each of the papers, looks for what's called a financial conflict of interest. If they can determine who funds it, whether there's any industry funding, they also looked for a professional conflict of interest. And that was defined as on those papers, at least one of the authors, one or more of the authors having worked for industry. And then they analyze it. And it should be pointed out, each of those separate tasks, finding the papers in the literature, reading them and characterizing them, and then looking at the conflicts, were each done by different people who didn't know what the other person did. So it was three independent sources. They then did statistics on the results, and they were very eye-opening. What they found is there were not enough studies where they could determine who funded it. I think there was only 7 out of 95, so they didn't find any difference there. But there was an extremely highly statistically significant difference when it came to professional conflict. Now, they found that there were 41 papers where at least one of the authors came from industry. In every single one of those cases, the paper found no problems. There were 51 papers where none of the authors came from industry. 39 of them found no problems, but 12 of them did indeed find adverse health effects. So that difference, 41-0 versus 39-12, that's an extremely highly statistically significant result. And what that tells you is that if you're going to find any unintended or adverse effect of a GE, if there's a single industry author on a paper, that is, if there's a professional conflict of interest, you will not find it. It's literally 41-0 versus 39-12. So that tells you the only way you're going to find evidence that there are problems is that there needs to be independently funded research that is done and published without industry authors on it. Otherwise, at least what this study shows is if there is any industry participation as an author, you will find that the paper says that there is no problem. So I've often challenged people when I hear about a new paper, if it has any industry funding, I ask, is there an industry author on it? And if there is, I say I don't even need to read it because I will predict that it will demonstrate that there's not a problem. That's what they've shown so far. So that shows why you need independent funding. That's why it's important that Europe is trying to look for that funding. And I think it raises serious issues for how we need to be doing our science. We should not be allowing companies to determine the kind of studies that can be done or who can do them.
When you mention Europe, I'm thinking about a meeting the FAO had in March. You were involved in a consultation there that was relating to the many times, the increasing number of times that other nations have blocked food imports from the United States due to GMO contamination. And it turned into a pretty big event. There were over 70 countries participating eventually, and you had the opportunity there to question the U.S. representative to the proceedings.
Yes. Well, what this meeting was about is it was a technical consultation on the low-level presence of GM materials in food and feed. And it isn't just from the U.S. It's other countries have blocked imports, and they can come from anywhere. FAO did a survey of almost 80 countries that have had problems. And if you look at the results, the three countries that are responsible for the vast bulk of the problem are the U.S., Canada, because of the Canadian rapeseed, and then also China. And China's a problem because they haven't approved, for example, BT rice, but they have no control, and it's actually being planted and it's being caught in, you know, rice products going into the European Union and other places. So what this meeting was about was how to deal with this low-level presence. I was actually asked to present the NGO view. And so what I did is I walked through both the biosafety protocol and what the Codex Alimentarius, these plant guidelines, has to say on that. But what I did also is in a back and forth with the U.S. government, I pointed out that we don't require safety assessments for engineered crops. And since this was a meeting that was about GE contamination, as it were, I pointed out that our U.S. Department of Agriculture does not even require sequence information or reference material for any of the engineered crops that are in field trials, which means they have no way of telling whether there's been contamination, because if you're not given the sequences of what to look for, you can't look for it. And when I challenged them, Michael Schechtman from USDA came back and said, well, yes, it is true that the FDA safety assessment process is voluntary, but he said all the companies go through it, and it's sort of like a question and answer session. It's sort of like a detailed PhD defense, which to my mind is sort of an absurd thing to say in a global meeting. But the second thing he said was, it might surprise people to know, but yes, the USDA, we do not require sequence information or reference materials for any experimental plantings, because there are thousands of them in the U.S. There have been. We only require that for the ones that will ultimately seek approval. Now, I was not able to respond and say, oh, you mean like LL601, LibertyLink 601 rice that in 2006 ended up contaminating half of the U.S. rice exports, costing over $1 billion to rice farmers, being the worst rice incidents in our history. And that was from a rice variety that was only tested experimentally. And actually, they stopped the experimental test in 2001. It was only grown for 3 years, and yet 5 years later, in 2006, it ends up contaminating half of our long grain rice exports. So the U.S., when they publicly admit in this meeting that they don't do safety assessments and they don't even require, they have no way of detecting whether there's contamination or not for the vast majority of crops that are field tested, there was virtually no support for the U.S. position. And at the end of the meeting, the thing that was nice is there was pretty much agreement that if a crop has not been approved anywhere in the world according to a safety assessment consistent with Codex, then there really should be a zero tolerance. Countries should be able to continue to block those crops if they want. And even in cases of what's called low-level presence, companies can decide to block those if they want or not. And I should point out, 55 countries right now have a zero tolerance for this. And this is causing trade problems for the U.S. And this meeting was, an attempt by the U.S. and Canada and the industry to try to find a way around this contamination problem, but they got no forward movement. In fact, they lost ground because what was said at the meeting is, again, if a crop hasn't been approved anywhere in the world, it's appropriate to have a zero tolerance. And even if it has been approved someplace, other countries can decide that they're not going to do anything until they assess it by themselves. And I should point out that the European Union did point out that they make no distinction between adventitious presence and low-level presence, that if they have not approved something for safety, they have a zero tolerance. And Japan said the same thing. They make no distinction either, and if they haven't approved it, it's zero tolerance. So this was actually a very interesting meeting, and it did not go well from the viewpoint of the U.S. or industry, but it was, I think, a big step forward because the NGO view about what's important and what the issues are, that's what the developing countries wanted to talk about, not these other issues of, well, this is just a trade disruption. Countries were asking questions like, well, is this safe? And how do we go about testing? So I think that was a very important meeting that happened on March 20th and 21st.
I'm thinking about how the U.S. trade policies very, very often represent industry. I'm thinking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We don't know a whole lot about it, but we do know that the TRANS isn't short for transparent. It's a so-called free trade agreement, but most of it isn't about trade, and it's anything but free, and it's being negotiated behind closed doors.
Oh, it's one of the most non-transparent things, and you're right. This is not just about trade. It's about financial mechanisms and other things. So I believe there are 600 industry lobbyists who have access to the documents, and our side does not. And in fact, the vast majority of folks in Congress have not been able to see these documents either, even in the Senate, people on the committees. So there's an issue not only with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but then also there's the TTIP, which would be the free trade agreement with Europe. A similar situation is there. That's all being completely non-transparent. And they do meet with industry, and they do meet with, for example, the Transatlantic Consumer Dialogue, which is all the consumer groups. But then when they meet, they say, well, we can't tell you what's in the TTIP, what the exact details are.
Well,
so in both of these cases, it's very non-transparent, and that raises concern over whether business interests might be trumping health and safety and other things. And one of the most upsetting aspects about both the TTIP and the TPP is this dispute mechanism where if a company decides the regulations in a country like the U.S. or even China or other countries, if they think they're impacting their own economic bottom line, the companies themselves will be able to go to a dispute panel to challenge a country's environmental or other laws, and that dispute panel would have three judges on it that rotate off from the industry. So this is a potentially horrendous process by which companies could help get rid of environmental and other regulations they don't like in any of the signatory countries to these agreements.
I'm thinking of a specific example. The European Union has so far rejected U.S.-raised beef from factory farms where growth hormones are used.
That's correct.
But the U.S. corporations are pushing to open European markets to hormone-tainted beef, and they're using the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership to do that. Why should people who care about things like GMO labeling and organic food and higher standards for meat production care about these trade pacts?
Well, they should care about them because a lot of the things that they've worked for in those trade pacts might be undermined. Because right now what Europe is saying is, okay, you want us to accept this meat. If you really want us to do that, it would have to come in and be labeled, you know, as being treated with artificial hormones. And, of course, the U.S. doesn't want that because then there'd be an indication on the package about that, and it probably wouldn't sell that much in Europe. But Europe has said that they're not about to accept this meat, or if they do, I know that they've offered, well, fine, maybe you can have some come in, and it has to be labeled. But right now, they're only allowing in unlabeled meat because the U.S. doesn't want to set the precedent of sending labeled meat. So there is some non-hormone-treated stuff that does go to Europe. And yes, that's one thing that the U.S. would like to get rid of as a trade barrier, but so would they would like to get rid of the labeling and other guidelines for GE in Europe as well.
Well, it seems that the U.S. industries don't want labeling of hormone-tainted meat. They don't want labeling of meat that's been raised with antibiotics. They don't want labeling of crops and plants that have been grown that are genetically engineered. The seeds are GM. They don't want the public to know what they're buying and what they're eating.
Exactly. And I would point out the other thing is in Europe, they don't allow drugs to be given to animals for non-therapeutic purposes. Drugs can only be given to sick animals. If it's not for a therapeutic purpose, it's considered unethical. It's in the code of ethics for the veterinarians. They shouldn't give that, and it's not allowed by law. Well, we have all these subtherapeutic antibiotics, growth promotion factors such as ractopamine and zopatterol that are put in our meat. Europe won't accept any of that. And actually, neither will China and Russia and a bunch of other countries. And we're trying to force Europe and others through these trade deals to accept that meat because we say it's perfectly safe. But that's another example. It's also the growth promoters such as ractopamine and zopatterol.
Michael, I appreciate your meticulous, knowledgeable, thoughtful voice. If we are indeed approaching a tipping point in which industrial agriculture's long-term influence is weakening, it's going to be in part due to your tenacity and your always intelligent efforts.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. And I do think that from what I'm seeing here, things are starting to move because even in the markets are starting to move more in the right direction. More, you know, folks are coming out and saying they're going to supply antibiotic-free food. Part of the reason, frankly, that Trader Joe's is having problems with all their meat is because there's a shortage for pork. There's more demand than there is supply because Chipotle and Whole Foods, for example, they will not accept meat from animals that have been given any antibiotics. With the GE, we have both organic, but then the non-GMO project with their non-GMO project verified seal, that very transparent process, that seal first appeared on the market in 2010 for the first time. By the end of January of 2014, it's now on more than 15,000 products with a total market value in the U.S. of over $5 billion. Last year in July of 2013, the USDA requires every meat label has to be approved by the government. It's the only food that that's true for. The USDA gave approval to the non-GMO project that if the companies can do it, they can now put a label on meat and liquid egg products. That non-GMO label would mean that it's from animals that have not been fed engineered grains or have not been fed engineered grains where there's more than 0.9%. So that shows that the market is moving. And in, you know, late 2013 and January of 2014, we had both Cheerios and Grape Nuts coming on with this non-GM saying that they're going to have non-GM products. So I think the market is starting to move, but we also need to move the regulatory apparatus in the right direction too.
Well, we greatly appreciate your efforts, both in educating the public and in educating legislators who are too often not very well informed and susceptible to control from industry. On behalf of everybody involved in the Food Revolution Network, Dr. Hansen. I thank you for being with us today and playing such a greatly needed role.
Thank you very much. And I would just like to, for you, John and Ocean, thank you for holding these food revolution summits, because this is part of the way that some of the information that I have can get out to a much wider audience. So we all play our roles, and you're playing a very crucial role in getting the information out as well. So I would like to thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hansen. It's an honor to bring your message to the world. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Hansen, Senior Scientist at Consumers Union. Dr. Hansen, in a world where agricultural policy is so often controlled by moneyed interests that are profiting from a toxic status quo, you are a refreshing and scientifically grounded voice in the public interest. We want to thank you so much for your time, for your penetrating insights, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you very much.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. And now here's another pre-recorded testimonial. This one is from Michelle, age 48, of Linden, Washington.
My name is Michelle Correa, and this is my food revolution story. I am a 46-year-old mother of three teenage daughters and wife to an incredible husband. I am full of energy, happiness, vitality, and love. But it wasn't always this way. I was the typical mother who was always so busy taking care of everyone that I often put myself last. Our lives were so busy that we ate a lot of processed and packaged food and items I thought were healthy that are marketed that way in the grocery stores. I was overweight, had a hip that would wake me up at night because it was sore, and hands that ached 24/7 from the arthritis in my knuckles. Don't get me wrong, I was still happy and full of love, but I knew that I had to make some changes if I wanted to live a long and healthy life and to be a healthy role model for our daughters. The Food Revolution Summit really opened my eyes to the depth of the issues surrounding our food supply system. I found out how big companies are pushing their agendas through the government and how their agendas are most often best for their bottom line, but not for our health. I feel angry when I think of all the things I had been feeding my family that were advertised as healthy, that were actually making us sick. Once I discovered the truth, I made big changes, and I have never looked back. Amazingly, the arthritis in my hands stopped hurting. My hips didn't wake me up at night from soreness. I lost a bit of weight, my skin looks healthier, and best of all, I feel incredible. I feel lighter, less sluggish, more vibrant, more alive, and more at peace. I also know that my choices aren't causing harm to animals and workers, to my body, or to the environment. My family also has joined me in eating healthier. This has had a definite impact on all of our health. As I became even more energetic than I already was, and filled my body with all the goodness that plants provide, I also took up exercising, and am now one of those people who regularly exercises no matter what, 3 to 5 days a week. This was a huge change. I have purchased 2 years of the Food Revolution Summit, and it has been an important part of my journey to better health. There is so much useful information to absorb, and the interviews are excellent. The depth of the interviewees is amazing, and I have listened to the presentations many times. With each listening, I gain an incredible amount of knowledge. The Food Revolution Summit just might change your life too. You will come away better educated to make important decisions for yourself. You will become aware of questions you should be asking that you never knew you should ask. You will become a voice to stand up for the health of our environment, our food supply system, and everyone involved. And if you listen, you will become healthier. I know I have.
to share your questions, insights, and reactions to what you've been hearing, and to find out what other people are saying, we'd like to invite you to post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. You will need, as always, to refresh the page if you want to see the latest comments. Our next presentation will be an interview with Environmental Working Group founder Ken Cook that will start at the top of the hour. Until then, here's some music from our friend, Bruce Bekvar.
Bye.